Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 305th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patrons Hayton Davidson, Robbie Ride, and John Mailer. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got Eric Kissack on the show. He's an old guest of ours and an old pal as well. And he is back on the show to talk about directing television. He has been editing feature films and TV shows, some of the best, for a long, long time. And he just did his first episode of network television. So we got him on the show to talk to him about the things that he learned, the dreams that came true, the things that were different and surprising. It's a great conversation. Oren, remind us of all of the incredible shows that Eric has worked on.
He just edited Pam and Tommy for Hulu, Rutherford Falls, which he directed, The Good Place, Black Monday, Veep. He edited Horrible Bosses 2, The Dictator, A Very Harold and Kumar Christmas, Cedar Rapids, Bruno, Role Models.
Just wall-to-wall bangers, yeah. He specializes in comedy, and he really knows what it takes to make a joke work. He's a really thoughtful, insightful guy, and very good about talking about the craft of filmmaking.
Yeah, and I think even if you don't care about TV or are not really on a trajectory for TV, I think you'll still find some really good tidbits in this interview, because we do just talk about the ethos of being a director and being on set and the relationship with your crew and with the people that are paying you. And I think it's really fun. I've talked about this on the podcast probably years ago, but he started this director's group where he would invite all his director friends to just come hang out in his house, have some wine, have some pizza, and just talk about directing, because directors rarely get to meet other directors. And that's where we met Carlin and we met Tim Nakashi there and all sorts of people that have been on the show since then. If you get one thing out of this episode that might be helpful, it's, hey, you should start a director's group.
A thing that I love about Eric's story is that it's such a great blueprint for people who want to have a meaningful, creative life that is a little bit more normal, perhaps. His plan was not to win the lottery ticket of a Sundance film or South by Southwest film or whatever. It was just put in the hours, be great, show people that you're great, and do it that way, you know?
Before we talk to Eric, we want to tell you about our Patreon, patreon.com/justshootitpod. It's a place you can go and support this podcast. If you feel like you get anything out of this, if you feel like you've learned what mistakes not to make that we've talked about, with websites to go find images for your treatment or whatever you think is helpful, and you want to help us out and keep the podcast going and pay our editor, go to patreon.com/justshootitpod. We appreciate it. For $15, you can get a Just Shoot It podcast hat, which is the coolest thing in town.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Us.
Me and Matt. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Two authorities on things that are cool.
Yes. No, but seriously, $15 a month gets you a Just Shoot It hat on patreon.com. And yeah, any other amount gets you your name shouted out at the top of this show. And hey, if we do a live show, it'll also get you a ticket to come. So hopefully,
you know, they're on the horizon.
You think 2022 there's a live Just Shoot It?
I really hope so.
Non-Zoom?
Yeah. Yeah, I really hope so.
Me too. On that note, let's get into the rest of this episode.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
We are here with Eric Kissack. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's been a while, buddy.
Yeah.
I should look it up. Eric, you were on nonstop and then life got in the way.
There was a pandemic, sure. I think.
Sure.
Yeah.
Kids, this is your first time remotely doing the podcast, I think.
That's right. It is much more convenient.
Yeah,
and like 30% less fun, right?
that's true.
But you know that we met Carlin and Tim, who've both been on the podcast actually quite a few times in the past few months through Eric. And Eric invented the director's group. And for people that are newer listeners and haven't listened to this show since we started 6 years ago, this show was kind of Eric's idea that I just stole.
I mean, I actually, you know, and all jesting aside, the bringing people together and you know, kind of forming communities is one of my great joys, and so it makes me happy to hear you say that.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Wow.
And script notes of directing.
Yeah,
Eric,
there you go.
Eric Kissack, 1995. You said that.
Yeah. It wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, I love the idea that script notes has been around since 95, though. It feels like it. It looks like the last episode you were on was episode 57.
Oh, no way. Wow. No, he didn't. Didn't you do a live show with us or no?
I don't think so. I don't think so. 57. We were on episode. This is 305, I think.
Yeah. 250 episodes ago. So,
geez, Louise.
Well,
this is on you mostly.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Well, so Eric, you just came off of editing Pam and Tommy, the HBO docu-series. The Hulu scripted series.
Yeah.
Before that, remind
listeners who haven't been sticking with us for
I feel like
quite
we'll
so
intro,
long.
We'll say it all in the intro.
Yeah, but just, you know, just to hear it out loud, straight from Eric's mouth.
What other shows he's worked on?
Yeah, what are your favorite highlights?
Highlights. I mean, The Good Place was a highlight for me. I edited 4 seasons of The Good Place. I did 1 season of Veep. I'm very proud of Pam and Tommy. I'm happy with it. I did a bunch of movies. I did a movie called Role Models, which I'm very fond of. A movie called Cedar Rapids that I'm fond of.
I forgot you. I love both of those movies, man.
Dude, and he did The Dictator. Sacha Baron Cohen. Horrible Bosses. Dose.
Yeah, a lot of fun movies. You know, like my journey has been sort of a journey of discovery, gentlemen. Because, you know, I discovered after like movie number 9 or 10 that I didn't actually like editing movies that much. Changed tacks into doing TV.
You think you didn't like it, or you just were bored with it?
I think I didn't know how to have honestly. Two things really. I didn't know how to have a good work-life balance. doing movies because movies are pretty like all encompassing.
Yeah, TV has stressful. A cadence to it, right? Like you turn in an episode and then you get to start fresh on the next episode.
The following very much so.
Right.
And it's also like, you know, people are always paying attention, you know, to TV, obviously, but like, it's like if one episode isn't the best thing ever, it's not like, how do we fix it? You know, I mean, like, yes, like you always try to make it the best you can, but it's like,
no career is ruined by, you know, a middle season episode on a network show.
It's like, okay, that episode could have been better. Let's move on. Let's nail the finale. You
know? Yeah. Don't submit that one to the Emmys. Right. Yeah.
But with movies, it's like, you know, like why, you know, why isn't this scoring higher? Why isn't this, you know? And then also in comedy, something happened along the way. And I don't really understand exactly why, but critics started to be much, much harder on comedy movies. Just really to start tearing them apart. And you'd think that I would learn not to care after a while, but I never learned not to care.
They won. We don't get them anymore.
No, yes, the critics won. Are you happy, critics?
Yeah, we don't get comedies anymore.
But critics are sort of like fairly light on a lot of television, you know. And I think I think that's sort of like the nature of television is, you know, critics are reviewing 2, 3, 4, even an entire season sometimes, but they're never reviewing the entire TV show from beginning to end. And so a TV show could have like a really terrible fourth season and end really lamely. And that doesn't really like get factored into the critics' reviews because it's just the nature of how it all works.
You're making me realize, thinking of, I know a handful of TV critics and they are a different breed than film critics. And they, I think maybe it's like, in order to be a TV critic, you have to have an insane appetite for media. You just have to be like, oh yeah, I want to watch stuff nonstop. You watch stuff
all the time. Yeah,
so if you don't love TV, it's too grueling and too poorly paid of a job to not to do, basically, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there are more fans, essentially, that are, not to you know, demean the profession or anything. Like, I'm in awe of a great critic's writing. But I do think you are coming into it more of a fan, perhaps.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so I said there were two reasons: quality of life, and well, part of it is just like you kind of touched on this a little bit, but like my first Hollywood movie was Role Models that I edited. That movie doesn't get made today. Like
and you mean like a mid-budget comedy that's got famous people but not A-listers in it.
Like there are mid-budget comedies on Netflix, but with teen TikTok actors that you've never heard of. Know, like, it's just a very different beast.
And when you say mid-budget, that number has changed significantly. Like, Role Models, I have no idea, but it's probably in the, you know, $20 to $50 million range. Correct. And like a TikTok influencer Netflix movie is like 1.5.
You know? Sure. And there's a different, like, there's still like the, you
there's
know,
like the 5 to 8 million
Joey King, around there. But yes, you're right. There's very few in the 30 to $50 million range anymore. Television. Anyway, long story short, television has done me well.
And Eric directed a feature too back in those days when you were editing features as well.
I did. Yeah. So along the way, I sort of caught the directing bug. Shoot a short film over a weekend, shot a feature film over 10 weekends as I'm like editing, you know, other things. It was only something I could do pre-kids. But it was great. I loved it and never, you know, sort of for whatever reason didn't make the thing that put me on the map. Necessarily.
Well, you kind of did, right? I mean, you made The Gunslinger. He made a short film, is narrated by Nick Offerman, and won all sorts of awards. It got you represented as a commercial director.
Yes. So The Gunfighter did sort of put me on the map. Only in the kind of like commercial realm. And I think probably the last time I was on the podcast, I was probably doing that. And it sort of began through this process of discovery in my life. realized that I didn't like it very much.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny, not to dive in too deep to it on it, but yeah. We do talk a lot about commercials, and I think that mm-hmm. Oren and I hear from a lot of listeners or who I think have been inspired to be like, oh, well, I'd love to do commercials and then also do narrative work. And so commercials are a good way to pay the bills and all that stuff. And Oren's always the first to say, hey, it's super competitive. It's super hard. You know, you should really, if you want to do commercials, you should really love it.
Like it's not like the easy side hustle you can do while you're at your screen.
It's not the gimme, but we never talk about how, like, I think most directors would dislike doing commercials. You do kind of like the pitching process and the, like, you're the, you know, the middle of the sandwich, I always say, creatively. You have to like say yes to a lot of creative input that you may or may not agree with after you've already eaten a lot of shit. It's really a shit eating job more than I think any other type of directing.
Unless you're a superstar director.
Yeah. If you're Lance Accord, you can be like, no, that's dumb. I won't do this, but. You know.
Yeah. Although, you know, I'm old friends with Ruben Fleischer, who was, you know, directed big giant movies.
Zombieland.
And he also does Zombieland, and he just did the new Uncharted movie. And he also does commercials. And I'm like, Ruben, like, when you do these big commercials, do you still have to just like eat shit and do whatever the client says? And he's like, oh yeah, of course. he has like very little control.
I do think there are directors like the David LaChapelle, you know, like they're almost like a creative director as well as a director, you know, a lot of photographers and people like that.
But it's probably like the 0.1%, not like the 1%. Right.
Yeah. Whereas I would describe Ruben Fleischer as like an A-list commercial director. Like, I knew he did a lot of music videos and stuff back in the day, but like when you can name multiple movies like off the top of your head that you know he did, you would hope that they don't have to do that sort of work. And it sounds like it makes sense they do.
I will say I work with Mike Mills, as we talked about, and I've been on a commercial set of his, and he does seem to have more free reign.
He gets to say no? Oh man.
Well, it's not that he gets to say no, but there is less of like a let's not move on until the agency tells us we can move on. Mm-hmm. You know, which is I think really like that's how our day moves. Is like, I think it's like we do a couple takes and fix some things, tweak some things, then I think it's good and I'm ready to move on. But then we have to wait to hear that the agency thinks it's good and is ready to move on.
Yeah.
And I feel like they trust him to say like, we got it, let's move on.
Yeah. You have to win it.
That makes sense.
Is what we're saying.
That makes sense. Yeah. The one thing I would add to your litany of commercial directing woes is, you know, as an editor coming from an editing background, it was dismaying how little input I had in the edit. You know, because I would sort of be like, hey, you know, I kind of know what I'm doing here. Let me like try a pass where this, and they're like, nah, we got it.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's like the 24-year-old ad exec who, you know, didn't go to film school, like, he's got it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was hard.
Yeah. I do think it's a different, like, there are, you know, editing commercials is its own thing, you know. In a way, totally. But yes, but I agree in terms of like why you want to be a filmmaker in the first place is because you like to talk about ideas, to put them together and to, you know, shepherd them into the world. And they exclude you from two of those three parts, you know, as a commercial director.
And with like the sensibility of like comedy, you know, most of what makes something funny is made or broken in the edit, you know?
Yes.
Stuff can totally crush and it can be a difference of 6 frames, you know.
Yeah, it's where you put that fart sound effect that really
exactly.
I not to reference old episodes, but we did have Don Sherrell on, who does a lot of Progressive ads or Geico ads, and he did talk about what makes a fart joke funny, what makes a fart sound funny. And I've referenced it too many times, but he was like, this isn't funny, that's not a funny fart sound. This is a funny fart sound. Oh. And it always It's storytelling in his performance, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think there is a good lesson about comedy, generally speaking. There's a build up and payoff, a prestige at the end. Anyway, Eric, we're burying the lead because you cut all of this wonderful work. You've worked on all these incredible TV shows, and you mentioned you caught the directing bug, and it kind of had been, a question of like, when was the right time for you to kind of step into that role and direct your own episode of television? And that happened.
It did happen. It's funny. So on the first season of The Good Place, I was working with Dean Holland one day, and Dean was an editor on The Office, who then started directing, I believe, on The Office, and then also Parks and Rec, and now is it's a fairly successful TV director. And I was like, hey man, I want to do what you did, and I want to be the TV editor who becomes the director. And he was like, yeah, man, just make sure people know, just tell people that's what you want to do, and do good work as an editor and make good relationships, and you'll be directing in 4 years. And I was like, I'm going to do it in 2.
And what year was this?
5 years later. Now, there was a pandemic in the middle of that, so I sort of feel like his 4 years is probably accurate if the pandemic hadn't happened. But yeah, goes to show you.
But this was on The Good Place.
That was on The Good Place. Yes, that was in The Good Place. And so I did not. So I got so Mike Schur, who created The Good Place, became a good cheerleader for me, which is amazing because he's a very talented writer and show creator. And so he wasn't able to get me on the schedule for The Good Place, but he did create a sort of web series for The Good Place that I directed in between season 3 and 4, which was 6 episodes. And so that was sort of my first kind of TV adjacent kind of thing, and it went really well. We got nominated for an Emmy. I sort of feel like it was a nice stamp of approval.
That was with
Mark Evan Jackson.
He's in Matt's movie, right?
He is in my movie. That's true. Yeah. He plays a cop. Delightful. And one of our producers works on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. So we're just typecasting him. Yeah.
he is wonderful. I love him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so then for Mike's next show, which was the show he co-created with Ed Helms and Sierra Teller Ornelas, a show called Rutherford Falls. The deal was that I would edit and then also direct. And so that happened.
And that's on Peacock.
So the first season is available now, and the second season comes out later this year. And that's the second season is the one where I directed.
Awesome. That's
and so exciting. Did you know it was going to be the second season that you get your episode? Like when you started?
So it was supposed to be the first season. And in fact, I was actually on the schedule and the pandemic happened. And this kind of happened to a number of people that I know where basically, instead of having 8 directors for a season, they went down to 3 because they just had to block shoot everything. And it was just the way that everything worked with the testing and everything. It's they couldn't do it.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough to be one of the directors who was on a show and was in the cadence of testing and stuff, you did way more episodes than normal.
Yeah.
I have a friend who's did 8 show episodes last year, but it was all kind of in the same production universe.
Yeah.
Get knocked off. Yeah.
I had a friend who was going to do 4 episodes of What We Do in the Shadows, and she ended up doing 8 because of that same thing. Yeah, I was good for you.
Yeah, cool.
That's 4 episodes, 4 directors that didn't get to do their episode.
Well, and also just to talk big picture, The Good Place is a great example of a network show that had a very limited season run. It used to be that... Like The Office, it was of course an editor gets to direct an episode. They were just tacking on extra episodes. They were in the heyday, they were doing 39 episodes a season or something bonkers like that. It was truly too many episodes. And
yeah,
so
they're handing them out like candy, you know. And then yeah, and that sort of, you know, it sort of like came around a little bit at the wrong time in that, yeah, when there's 13 episodes instead of 22 is, I guess, was normal, you know. That makes it harder. Rutherford Falls, we do 8 episodes, so was like a big thing. But
showrunner typically will do a couple episodes, and then, you know, if you've got a directing producer, they get eaten up pretty quick, you know.
Very quickly. Yeah.
Is so I'm curious, and for our listeners too, like when you you are now on the schedule to direct an episode of Rutherford Falls. Who needs to approve you? Like, do network executives need to approve you? Do you have to show any of your directing work, or is it the fact that you've edited 800 episodes of TV enough?
No. So yeah, it's a great question. The network has to approve all the directors, and it's a little bit of catch-22 because you basically can't direct until you've directed, you know? And so it was actually something. So Mike actually co-created a little show, little known show that was quite lovely, called Sunnyside, that was on for a few episodes, and that was actually the show he sort of co-created after The Good Place. And he was like, all right, like, this is it, this is, you know, this is the one that you're gonna direct. And he like sent my name to NBC and they were like, no. And he was like, but I'm Mike Schur. And they're like, no. And so, you know, he kind of like then sort of had a talk, and he was like, look, you know, what qualifies someone as like being eligible, you know, like if we do this web series that we're talking about doing for The Good Place, like, would that qualify? And they were like, yes. So I don't know.
Did they care? Rule. Did they care if you were DGA at all? Does that make any difference?
No, no. I don't care about that.
You know, Eric, we'd made a little joke about, you know, inexperienced clients and ad executives. But some people, I don't know any of the people that you worked with, and, you know, but studio side, it can be a similar situation where you come up, you've got a degree in marketing or business or something like that. And, you know, you maybe don't have a ton of set experience, or maybe literally don't know what most people's jobs are. You know, like there's a huge spectrum of really awesome studio people to people who don't have any business in media. And so, Orin, your point of like, well, you know, what makes someone qualified in their eyes, it can be a little bit of a crapshoot, right? Like, it's not like like a checklist and it was like, well, if Eric scores 80 on this aptitude test, he's good to go, you know?
I mean, the one thing I'll say is that, you know, TV is, everything is tight in TV. The budgets are tight. The schedules are tight. You can't, like, not make your day in TV. You know?
It's risk averse on the directing side.
It is very, very risk averse. And so, like, you know, that's their biggest fear, that someone goes on set and just like, it's not that they don't know how to like work with the actors. It's not that they don't like understand blocking. It's literally that like, they don't know how to make their days, you know? And I kind of am sympathetic to that. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to that because I know, you know, I know what a domino effect it has if you wind up like going a half day over or something, you know?
Well, until you point about you're missing the shots that you need for the scene.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So, yeah. So, I mean, I think that like, so I think that's why like, oh, he shot 12 pages of a web series in a day, you know, like, okay, he can do it. You know, like, it's like the one thing that I sort of like, I get, I'm like, okay, like I proved that I knew how to like, you know, just literally stuff the meat in the sausage.
Even well, though you've done a feature where you probably had to do that too, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's also like just the vindication of, they can be, if their boss is like, well, who let Eric do this? They can be like, well, he shot 12 pages in one day. We thought he could do it. Right. Like, or they did it for another network. Right. That's the catch 22 you were alluding to.
So it's not that much about your creative talent as much as your ability to execute.
I mean, I think the creative talent comes with like someone saying, hey, he can do this, you know, like someone like Mike or Morgan Sackett, who's, you know, produced The Good Place and a bunch of other things, like, Veep and Hacks, you know, like, you know, the people that they trust to make the show are saying, okay, we think this guy can do it.
Right.
So that's the creative side. And then the kind of like made your day side, I think, is just like the experience. Like, what has he done? Like, what can I point mm-hmm. to? I don't even need to watch it. I need to like see that he did it.
Right. Yeah, truly. Yeah.
And then, sorry, just to ask about this one more time, but how soon from when you started working with Mike and these other people, did you tell them that you want to direct? Like,
I told them in the interview, but when I met them.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because like, you know, because smart people are never going to say like, you know, well, sorry, that'll never happen, you know, but you can mm-hmm. sort of like tell from their reaction, like, are they really open to this? And, you know, they immediately spoke about people like Dean and Claire mm-hmm. Scanlon, who's another mm-hmm. director who we edited for them. You know, they were like, yeah, we like that. We like, you know, supporting people from our world from inside. And we specifically like editors. And so, you know, it was a good answer.
Because there is like kind of this idea sometimes that you shouldn't, if you apply for a job, you shouldn't tell them you want a different job, you know?
Yes.
If you're applying to be a PA on a music video, you know.
Well, the difference being though, like there are show creators and there are companies effectively that have a culture of promoting from within, and there are places that don't at all. And it is valuable, I think, for you to know. I mean, Eric, you were coming from a place of, you know, stability to some extent. You had a career, you had a resume under your belt. So if you didn't get that job, it wouldn't be like, oh, well, now I'm destitute. Exactly. Right. But like,
yeah.
I mean, I know so many editors who were like, dang, like just get stuck as assistants forever, 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 and never get promoted, and then just move to a different show creator and just fly up the ranks immediately. And it's just kind of like,
yes,
there's a style to each different show and each different showrunner. And I think Mike Schur, I think, is kind of famous for being really good about promoting from within.
Yes, yes. Although if you ask him about it, he would say it's because he doesn't like meeting new people. so he just likes to have the same people just do more things.
Yeah. So if you can PA for Mike Schur, you'll probably get an episode.
There you go. There you go.
In 4 years.
Well, so I'm curious, how do you feel now after having directed those episodes? You know, was it worth it? Do you like it?
Or did you get, how many episodes did you do?
I did one.
One.
It was wonderful. It was a great mm-hmm. experience.
You're not looking any gift horses in any mouths, for sure. No, right.
No. I mean, I loved it. And you know, it's a funny thing. Like, I think that a few years ago I would have been like, this is it, you know, first step mm-hmm. one. And then like, mm-hmm. you know, like would have been like waking up every morning trying to figure out how to get episode two, you know? Mm-hmm. But I still want to do more, but like something, the pandemic, changed editing for the better. Almost every editor I know, including myself, works from home now, which I guess this is personality specific. For me and for almost everyone I know, it's a massive improvement. You know, the not having to do the commute, just being, you know, in your own comfortable space is delightful.
Right.
Some of the hardest
every day.
Pantsless, like now. one of the hardest things about editing is that you're always kind of working on other people's schedules. You know, you're working with producers who are running back and forth from set. You're working with a director who maybe is like planning their next shoot, that kind of thing, mm-hmm. you know? And so
it's a lot of late nights.
It's a lot of late nights, and it's a lot of just like waiting around the edit room for someone to show up, you know? And when I'm waiting around in my house and like, you know, like, I don't know, like watching a TV show or something, or, you know, like, sure. or playing with my kids or something. And then like
living your life.
It's like, hop on, you know, it's dramatically better. So that really improved. And then conversely, directing got worse. And like, hopefully this is temporary. Obviously, we all want this to be temporary. But like, being in the masks is not that fun. Communicating with actors and crew in the mask is pretty hard. Everything is like a little bit more, you know, by now a lot of the kinks have worked out, so it's like mostly okay. But like, you know, you're still like slowing down every now and then because like the COVID compliance officer is like, oh, there's too many people on this set, you know, or someone gets sick or something, you know. There's a lot. There's like maybe like 10% more stress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like 10% less camaraderie, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's a huge part of it.
I would say more. It's less fun. You can't like sit. There's two people to each table still. You know what I mean? Like you don't just get to hang out at lunch or like.
You don't even like shake people's hands, you know, not that makes such a difference, but there is like a thing of like saying hi and seeing each other's face.
You don't know what half of someone's face looks like sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, you see them at lunch and you're like,
the real problem when you have a set crush on someone and then you see the rest of their face at lunchtime and you're like, oh my God.
there was an actor who I was working with in one scene and I was really funny and nice. And we had a great time. And then at the end, he was like, can we take a selfie? And I was like, totally. And we like took our masks off and he goes, oh my God, that's what you look like. And like, he wasn't kidding. Like he just like had something about the bottom of my face. It was just like very, all that's to say, I love the experience. I want to keep doing it, but it's not like I don't lie awake at night thinking about how I'm going to get the next episode, which I think is probably for the best because from all that I've heard, you know, getting your first episode of TV is like impossible. And getting your second episode of TV is like slightly less impossible, you know?
Yeah. But still mostly impossible. Yeah.
But still mostly impossible.
Yeah. And then your third, then you're off to the races. Then you're fine. Then
yeah. I mean, I think like three or four, then it's like you're doing, you're like gangbusters. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just from what I heard right here. But yeah.
But so,
the question is, what was it worth it? Like,
yeah,
for sure. I mean,
I guess that's not a good question because, of course, you have to say it was worth it for many, many reasons. I guess maybe better, like what was better than you were hoping and what was maybe a little harder than you thought?
Better for sure was just how awesome the crew was. Just like how like
awesome
talented.
How? Yeah.
Just. You know, like we had three camera operators and they were each was like incredible, you know, and like could do anything, you know. And once you realize like, oh, I have this tool that can like, it's like a hammer, but it can transform into a screwdriver and it can, you know, like you just realize like these people can do anything, you know, like at one point we brought in a crane and it wasn't like, you know, like I asked for it days ahead of time, you know, but I was like, oh, is there going to be a crane operator? But like one of the awesome camera operators just like jumped on the crane and started like operating the crane. And I was like, oh, you do that too. That's cool. And then I was like, wait, can the camera move up and then down and then straight? And he was like, it can do anything. And I'm like, that's incredible.
There is something about indie films and shorts and commercials where, you know, every day you're kind of rediscovering. The crew is like learning to work together and your idea for this car rig or the Movi move or the techno crane or whatever that you're so excited about and boarded, you know, so precisely. And then you're on set and you're like, the camera can't move this way because they forgot this part or the, like there's all these things where like, you know, who directed that wrestling movie with Steve Carell?
Bennett Miller.
Fox Bennett Miller, Fetcher. I saw him.
Doctor,
I saw him do like.
We were
intro.
Thinking funny, where it was like, "Oh, a zany wrestling movie." That'd be great.
First, I was thinking Aronofsky for the
right.
I was thinking win for saying, but Foxcatcher. He did. I watched it the movie, and he did the intro to it, and he said that the you know when you make a movie, you have like what's in your head and what's on the monitor. And like your whole job is to try to bring those two things as close to each other. They'll never be the same thing. But then I think when maybe you're working on TV or something and you're like, hey, I want to have like a nice over the shoulder shot or like close up, or maybe we'll follow this character into this house. And you imagine it'll be like okay, because the 100 last times you did it, it was like, okay. And then all of a sudden the operator is like, doesn't. You're like, wow, that's so much better than I expected. Can you also yeah. orbit around them? And like, yes. yeah. And the things that like in past experiences, when you're like, let's start removing things because we made it too, I imagined it too complicated, but you know,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
I have not really had that experience too much where I get dropped into like a super seasoned crew that works mm-hmm. like right. a machine, except, you know, when Matt directed some stuff for Ellen and I was drone operating. So I kind of like was just mm-hmm. on the sidelines. And that team,
yeah, yeah, they were
like, you don't even need to direct them. They just, they're like, yeah, okay, yeah. I'll be here. Does that work? And Matt's yeah, like, yeah, maybe you get this, make sure to catch this moment. And that's it, you know?
Yeah.
Or as opposed yes. to like me, I'm like, okay, so what we're doing is, yeah, no, that's not Mike. That's my, you know, like trying to explain to them what we're even shooting, you know?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No, this is very much the Ellen version. Yeah. I'm curious. I want to ask, because part of my like unexpectedly enjoyable part of it was actually how much I just liked the crew personally. Mm-hmm. Like they were all just like interesting men and women. They all had like interesting stories and I just like wanted to hear their stories and they clearly liked the fact that I wanted to hear their stories.
You were I've been locked in an office for a decade.
It got in my head that like I've heard people say that, I can't remember, that like I'm going to paraphrase, but it's like, you know, like, don't care about the crew liking you or like the crew shouldn't like you or some, you know, thing. And I'm like, where does that come from? You know, because I just kind of feel like A, it's super fun, mm-hmm. you know, like getting to know people in general, and B, like, it felt like when, like on my day three, when they were like, oh, this guy is nice and respectful and like is always saying nice things to me, I felt like they were doing better work, you know, like, mm-hmm. Like, I wonder what you guys think about this.
You're not
there to make friends. That's what it was. Right, you're not there to make friends. Right.
Well, I do remember an AD once telling me, and this was on probably the longest thing I ever did. It was like, it was the Go 90 series. It was 8 half-hour episodes. So it was long. Like it was the same crew the whole way through. It was awesome. I loved all of them. But I do remember my AD telling me like, sometimes you're going to have to ask this crew to do things they don't want to do. And right. I think there, you can't let yeah. the mentality of like, these people are my friends, stop you from making them stay late when they, yeah. right. they don't want to.
Or murder someone.
Yeah. On a show, like this show was weird. It was, there's a lot of stunts and there, you know, like there's a lot of different moving parts. And so it was hard and tiring. And so even though they were a well-oiled machine, at a certain point, I was like, you know, you're always confronted with a thought of like, oh, I could do the easy way or I could do the good way. And right. I know the good way is going to like mean that my Steadicam operator is going to have to sprint, you know, every single take to get it right or whatever it is. And, you know, that's, I think, maybe where that mentality comes from. But 100% you can be friends with your crew and you should be friends with your crew because it is fun. And also they yeah. will do better work.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it is like a balance and it's why the crew matters so much, because if you have a really good crew, then you can be friends with them and they'll impress you and you can say like, hey, what do you think about this shot? And they'll come up with a better shot or they'll mm-hmm. be like, I love it. Let's do it. You know, I do find when I have like really solid crew members that like trying to get them engaged in like the decision-making makes them mm-hmm. better. Mm-hmm. And yeah. they want to stay late and nail it and give me one more chance. I think I can mm-hmm. get that. Like,
yeah.
But when the crew's not great or they're grumpy or whatever, like you have a costume designer that like kind of brought the wrong costume and you're like, well, can you fix that? Can you sew that? And they're like, well, I mean, I could drop everything now and go to, you know, the mall and buy the new things if you really hate this thing, you know? And then your choice is either like, well, I want to get the thing that I asked for, or like, I guess this mm-hmm. thing you got, it's not right, but it'll work, you know? And I don't yeah. want you to yeah. be pissed off at me because I have 100 other things I need from you today. So yeah. I think that's probably the more typical situation where, I don't know, Matt and I are kind of like this, like debate this all the time, but I think especially in a commercial, even a feature film or something, if you're making something that is going to represent you as a filmmaker, that's going to potentially put you on the map or get you the next job or whatever.
I should point out, literally every single time Oren's like, we disagree, Matt's going to disagree with me strongly and does all the time, he will say something that I like staunchly agree with.
Well,
but finish your thought and then I'll let you know. I will answer honestly.
But like, I think at the end of the day, all that matters is what's like for your career is what is the final edited piece. Mm-hmm. And the experience on set, while the fun of directing is having fun on set, you know, that's mm-hmm. why we want to do this. But it doesn't matter beyond that day, you know. And I think one of my weaknesses as a director is that I focus on that. I want people to have a good time. I want people mm-hmm. to be happy. I want
people pleasing
to do good work. Yeah. And I've even been told by producers like that I'm not selfish enough, that I'm like, mm-hmm. you know, a little agree on the agreeable side. And if I really want a shot because I think it'll be cool for my reel or my website or my director's cut and there isn't time for it, it's the first one I'm going to cut. Right. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not fighting for the stuff that I know that like the client or the producer or whatever doesn't want. So,
yeah.
So I think in that situation, like being nice to the crew, making it fun for the crew can be a detriment for the final product. So yeah.
I don't know,
you shouldn't prioritize someone's like the crew's feelings over the final product. But if the crew is making the final product better, and the happier they are, the better the product is, then you should by all means be friends with your crew and be nice. I mean, you should always be nice.
It seems like it's not, at least in my very limited experience, it's not hard to do both, right? Like it's not hard to get the thing that you think is important and that you want. And also to, I mean, it's not even like, you know, it's like literally like every time after every take, I'd be like, that was a great move, or like, mm-hmm. or that light looks great, or, you know, it's just like little things like that. Like, you know, I think, I don't know. I've heard so many stories of people who were on set and just said a nice word to, you know, the camera mm-hmm. operator or something. And like, you know, some like seasoned guy has done like, you know, has been shooting for 20 years or something, would just light up and just be like, oh, wow, thanks. You know, because like, I don't think that's the norm.
I think that's true. I think that like, it's easy for people to be taken for granted, you know?
Yeah.
And that is a good takeaway to remember to tell people that are doing things you like, that you like those things.
Yeah.
I think some of it sometimes is that like some people, depending on what their background is, don't know that what they're doing, what their crew is doing at all, A, or B, that it's hard. Do you know what I mean? Like, because they're so seasoned, they make it look easy. But like, because you've done so many things where you didn't have the resources, your person didn't have the skill to pull it off, it's a delight when they do it. And like, those people got great at their craft because they love it. And so, of course, they love being acknowledged for nailing it.
Yeah. Matt and I always disagree about this, but you should be a good person.
Wow, Matt.
Yeah, yeah. Then finally, you got one right, Oren.
No, and I don't know. I mean, it's kind of like champagne problems also, like to work with like the best people in the business.
Well, but you bring out, I think Eric's point is that you bring out even better work with people when you're all having a good time and collaborating together. And I think it makes the thing that, Oren, you were saying a little bit easier, right? We're going to hit those speed bumps where, shoot, you do need to do it again because it was out of focus. But because your, you know, focus puller knows that you appreciate them, they're not mad at you when you're like, I was a little soft on that one, let's do it again.
I will say, when focus is good on a really hard shot, I try to call it out, where I think a lot of people don't realize that it was hard.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, I'll be like, I know this is like a really, you know, 100mm lens, someone's running right towards us, I know this is tricky.
Yeah.
Good job. Yeah.
And also, like, it's, I get excited when they nail it too. Like, knowing how hard it is, like, there's a camaraderie to like the visceral feeling of someone else. Totally. It feels like that's the closest I get to a team sport, I guess is what I'm saying.
Then you get it into the edit bay and it's totally out of focus. Like,
Eric, you were going to say something important.
Well, you asked, I was just going to pivot. You asked, like, I think you said surprisingly hard or difficult. You know, I knew that I had to be flexible because I knew at some point, at any point, the showrunner could walk on set and just be like, no, I don't want you to do it that way, you know? And I knew that was a possibility. And I thought that I was like prepared for every contingency, you know, but I just wasn't, because you just can't be. Right. And so I think, like, you know, and this is, so like we talked earlier about commercials, right? On commercials, you probably have like the least amount of control in this like range of things, you know, like your like indie movie passion project, you probably have like the most amount of control. TV is squarely in the middle. You know, there's a lot of things where it's like you do get to choose your coverage. You do get to mostly choose your blocking, and, you know, there's a lot of things that are just up to you. And then there's some things that the showrunner just cares a lot about. They care a lot about, you know, what this character is wearing, because they're like, you know, this character always needs to be projecting this specific image, and we've written this person from day one and they need to be wearing this, you know? And so learning like what they care about and what they don't care about and like where there's, you know, spend your energies. But just in the heat of the moment, you know, maybe you're like falling a little bit behind. You're like, okay, we gotta hurry. And then having a showrunner say like, hey, look, I didn't like that. I didn't like that the way that looked. I want you to do it again. And like, you know, frame out this thing, you know? And that's part of the job. That's it. Everyone knows that's what it is. And it's really hard, you know, and there's no way to have a plan B for every possible thing that needs to change. And most of the time it's fine. It's like an easy thing. You just do it one more time differently, you know, but sometimes it's like, oh, wow. Okay. You want something that's going to require additional setup, and that setup is going to take another half an hour, you know, and that kind of thing. I guess I shouldn't say it was surprisingly difficult. I knew that would be difficult, but I think I thought that I would be better at like rolling with the punches. And it's not like I like lost my mind or like, you know, broke down and started throwing things or that kind of thing. You know, I got like
surprised. Flustered. Yeah. Yeah.
Surprised and kind of like, okay. You know?
Yeah.
And I was like so good at keeping my cool up until that moment, because it is, you know, I mean, you're sort of like, there's 100 people on set who are there to do what you say, you know, and it's a lot of pressure and that's a lot of anxiety, and it was all going really well. And it did go like 99% well, but like, I always run back in my head those like one or two moments where like, you know, a wrench got thrown in the works and I was like, wow, I'm like spiraling a bit right now, you know, and then pulled it back together. And I actually like kind of like, you know, reached out to some director friends who've done a lot of TV and sort of asked how they deal with it. And the answers were great. It made me feel a lot better. It was basically like, it's always terrible and there's no good way to deal with it.
And so for people that don't have a lot of experience in the TV world, just to clarify what we're talking about is, you're pretty much the boss on set. You have a schedule. You're trying to shoot 12 pages a day or whatever on this show that has a budget and a network and all sorts of
people. And just to reiterate, just to remind, if you don't make your day, that is the main indicator of whether or not you are hireable again for the next job.
Right. You're a good director.
Totally. Yeah.
And so you are trying to hurry through and do everything, and you're just about done with a scene, and then someone comes in and says, hey, we think you should also get this additional setup. That's not a trivial one. It's not like just switch to a tighter lens and get another take. It's like, make sure you get it from this angle, because we really want to have these two characters in the shot together, or we want to see the door.
The crucial thing to understand is that like, that is normal. And that is ultimately probably good, because most TV has like one person whose job it is to keep the show, you know, to make sure the show is the same. And that is the showrunner. That is, you know, the showrunner is often the creator, sometimes, you know, the head writer, whatever. But is a director can come on and direct an episode or two and maybe like have not even watched the show. You know, that happens a like surprising number of times. So that showrunner has an incredibly important job, which is to make sure that the show is always with the same tone and voice and that kind of thing. So it's good that person's there. Just sometimes hard to to deal with.
Sure.
And do you show the showrunner your shot list and your blocking, your overhead diagrams, all those things before you shoot your show, your episode?
If it's a normal scene where it's just like, you know, two people are sitting having a conversation, like, no. If it's like, oh, here's a gag, it's like a big visual, like, you know, someone, it's like a reveal or someone runs into a room or something, then yes. It's sort of just like if the blocking and the coverage affects a joke, then yes, but otherwise not necessarily.
Right. You've gone over all the blocking and shots with the DP before you get to set, obviously, right?
And so the first AD.
So they might at some point say, like, by the way, they usually don't use this. I mean, you know this show, obviously. You edited this show. Right. So you're a special exception to this rule. So yes. How this show gets covered.
But 100%, yes. The DP is often like the first line of defense where they'll say, you know, because you'll be shoplifting with the DP before you even maybe have an extensive conversation with the showrunner. And they'll say, like, you know, we don't really do a lot of handheld. Like, you know, maybe we do it in some instances, but I wouldn't plan on shooting this handheld. Or like, yeah, we don't use a lot of dollies or whatever. You know, they'll let you know.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then did you find it difficult to put like your own spin on the episode? Or is that something that was important to you?
I got a little bit lucky in that, just luck of the draw, I wound up in an episode where the characters leave town.
Mm.
So we ended up, you know, I think 90% of the episode happens on sets that were new, locations that were new, that kind of thing. So that was actually wonderful for me to be able to kind of like put my stamp on a couple of little things. You know, it's not like I'm like Quentin Tarantino going into directing an episode of ER. Like it wasn't like dramatically different, but did everyone remember that?
Yeah. No, I didn't. Did he do that?
This is like the heyday of ER. It was like the awesome. Most watched show on television, and Quentin Tarantino directed an episode and it was like bonkers.
great. Good.
But yeah, no, I got to put a little bit of a stamp. Two other things surprised me. Go through them very quickly. One is how easy it is to lose momentum. You know, in the beginning, you get there and you're full of nervous energy and you're just like, okay, we're making something. Let's go, let's shoot, you know. And by day three, like you are getting comfortable. You're like, oh, like everyone knows me now. And like, I'm like, shoot the shit. And you know, and you just realize that like, it's not like you're just like sitting there for half an hour having a conversation and people are like, what the hell's happening? You know, 30 seconds here, you know, a minute there, like little things. And like, obviously you have an AD, you have like a crew, like keeping things going. But like everyone takes their cues from the top. And I just noticed that like that little shift in my energy of like just being like a little bit more comfortable actually slowed us down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we actually like lost a little bit.
That's
little,
why you can't become momentum. You can't become friends with the crew. How many times have to tell you?
I know.
Well, it does make me think of earlier before where you were talking about a moment where you got, you know, caught off guard when the showrunner came in with a note. I think the thing that's tricky about all of that is that like everything is so precisely planned. You're talking about like, oh, you lose 30 seconds here and all of a sudden the momentum of a show slows down. You know, the train gets a little slower. Outside of lunch, there's not really any time for you to just take a deep breath and take stock of things. And that's the problem. If you just had like a 5 minute smoke break every single hour to just like think real quick and like, you know, check shots off and like double check, like, oh, maybe we can consolidate the shot I just realized or whatever it is, you would go that much faster. But it's just like there's no water break. You're just constantly running on that treadmill.
I mean, I guess there's like moving from setup to setup.
Yes.
And have a moment to think. To panic.
And absolutely. Although what I realized was that like the best thing for me to be doing during that time was running lines with the actors. Because, you know, something like we'd get more comfortable with the lines and then sometimes we'd find like a little moment to add a joke or something like that, you know? So it was like, there really, my experience was what Matt was talking about. Like there wasn't any moment to sort of stop, you know?
Wait, so you're, we didn't even really talk about directing actors and stuff. I guess I always think of TV as like the actors know the characters so much better than you, you know, how much like were the actors receptive? I mean, obviously they probably know you from working on the show, but were they receptive to you coming and standing with them and giving your opinion on their performances and how they can make things funnier?
Absolutely. Yeah, they wanted it. In my experience, you know, an actor wants feedback. They always want feedback. They, you know, even if it's like, this is great, you know, keep going in that direction. But so, yeah, it's not like I'm like there to be like, you know, Ed Helms, like your character isn't really like, you know, it's funnier if these two sentences come quicker, you know, or if it's actually, it's funnier if you stop and kind of like think for a second, you know, like little comedy tweaks for sure.
Did you think those out like ahead of time? Did you have notes on your script that you're like, oh, maybe I'll like some performance ideas or alts or anything?
Some, yeah, a few, yes, yes. I wouldn't say for every scene, but you know, for some. And then, but then sometimes you just like, you know, I mean, Ed is a very, very talented improv guy, and he would like come up with an improv, and then I would like maybe add to it, be like, oh, that's great, you know, try this version where you then kind of go into this run, sort of guiding him that way. You can't just do it by yourself. You can't just be up there flailing around. You know, you need to sort of, you need someone to say like, this is working, or like, this is working, but it needs to be half as long or something.
Did you ever pitch a joke and they're like, nah.
No, but there were a couple times where I pitched a joke to Ed and he would say, I don't think my character would say that, you know? And I'd be like, totally understand.
Right.
When you were editing the show, you were one of the main people who decided what take got picked, right? So there is this like, or at least you were there when a take got swapped out and, you know, the final take was picked, right? So that does give you an insight that probably most other directors and none of the cast really has. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was that ever brought up in any way, or like there was that the subtext, or is this the first time you're thinking of it?
I think it is some, like a couple times I had rehearsed, like, you know, you sort of go through your head of like all the different versions of how it can go. And I remember like at one point, you know, cause I mean, the thing that we're always working in the edit for comedies, we're always trying to punch, do the speed, just tighten the speed, tighten the hair, get everything moving faster, get everything sort of punchier. And so part of what I was trying to go for on set was to try to create as much of that speed and energy as possible. So I didn't have to like be cranking it in the edit. And I was expecting a little pushback, a little bit of the actor sort of being like, that's, I can't say that fast. It seems crazy. It feels crazy. And then sort of like I prepared the speech of sort of being like, well, this is what we have to do in the edit in order to get to that speed. Eventually we have to like cut away from you at this key moment because we need to like stitch together two lines or that kind of thing, you know? So if you can do, and I wound up not ever having to give that speech because the actors were like, oh, cool. Yeah. Fast. Sure.
Oh, fast. Cool. Yeah. You put your envelope back in your pocket.
I assume you threatened them a lot by saying that you'll use their worst takes if they didn't do things that you liked, right?
Yes, yes, for sure. No, I mean, Ed did actually have a runner where I would be like, you know, can you do it this way? And he'd be like, well, only if you don't use it. He'd be like, I promise I will not use it.
You said there was a third takeaway?
The third takeaway was, what an abject failure I was at seeing my work clearly in the edit, which was something that was very, very depressing to me, because as someone who's done the other side of that so many times, working with directors, working with first time directors, and just like walking them through something and being like, look, man, like, or look, woman, you know, like, I know you remember this happening this way on the day, but like, look at the footage with me, like, it's not working, or we need to do it this way, or actually this thing that you see and you think is terrible is actually great. You know, like, your experience is clouded so much by your experience on set, or your way of your you know, reaction to it. And I was like, I can short circuit that crazy mental problem because I've gone through it so many times, you know. And I just couldn't, like, I could not see it. I couldn't, like, I would watch a scene and I'd be like, I don't know if that is crap or good, or too fast or too slow or anything, you know? And eventually eventually I could. And it happened. It just has to happen. It had to be like watching it over and over again and smoothing out a lot of the edges. Cause that would be something where it'd be like, I watch something and I'd see like a weird camera shutter or blink or something like that. And I'd be like, rationally, that shouldn't destroy my appreciation of the scene, but it just did. So let's fix that.
Mm-hmm. You know? So you're like just, you're just thinking about production. And so you can't think about the edit. Is that what you mean? Or
it's partially that. It's partially just like, just so in my own head of like, did I do a good job? Like, does this feel like an episode of this TV show? Like, did I somehow mm-hmm. create something totally weird and different and wrong? You know, mm-hmm. I don't have any like great, complete understanding of exactly why it was so hard for me. Mm-hmm. But it happens so often, with directors, even directors who have directed it like a ton, you know, like I've done like some of my best. I know there have been episodes of TV that I've edited where I like just nailed the edit. Like I just got mm-hmm. it right. And like 99% of it didn't change. And you show it to the director and they're like, okay, that's a good start. You know, and you're like, sure. No, dude, this is great. Yeah, trust
me. This is the best we got. Did it change your relationship to the editor? I assume you knew this editor beforehand, right? Yeah. How did it evolve? I guess I'm curious.
So my normal assistant, named Keith Mahoney, who he's actually co-edited a couple episodes of The Good Place and Rutherford Falls with me. So we work together a lot. He edited it.
Great.
And great. I don't think it changed our relationship. No. I mean, I think that, I think that like I was like apologized a lot to him for being a crazy person, but, I think he understood.
It is. I mean, it is a really good lesson to just get another point of view. If you direct and edit your own stuff, just how important it is to get another point of view on the edit, because we're all guilty of like, I'll watch something that I shot and I'll be like, oh, why did we not, you know, just pan over to the right a little bit, or why didn't we do this? Mm-hmm. Or why didn't, like, I think in terms of the camera, or why didn't the performance, or why didn't I have her do it a little faster? Like I start mm-hmm. second guessing my decisions on set, when in reality you're in the edit and like all you should focus on is like if this shot is working for, you know, the scene or whatever you're creating. Yes. It doesn't matter.
There's a lot of letting go that you need to do, and that is hard sometimes.
I will say sometimes editors will be like, well, why didn't you get this shot? And I'll that is me, literally my most defensive. Some editors are, definitely. No, they're not like, why didn't you get this shot? But that
they'll be like, oh, did you get an answer to this? I didn't find it. Yeah.
Yeah. Or like, you guys have an awful lot of takes of this one. Do you get anything else? Or like, you know, there's some, you know, it's always informed by the thing of like, well, why you weren't on set. You don't know, you know, the there's literally a fire burning behind us and, you know, or whatever. And that's me being purely defensive. Like, you know, obviously that's me, not them. But
the worst
is
when I'm like, and tell the editor, like, I know we got that. We got the take where she said it this way, you know? And they're like, no, you didn't.
the best is when the AE just missed that take and you're like, no, she pull up the raw and then you find it.
Yeah. Never with Eric's edit team. They don't miss anything.
That's right. Yeah.
My last question about your TV directing/editing is, look at your life and your career moving forward from here. What's the ideal thing? Like you kind of edit half the time and direct half the time, or would the more ideal thing be to just direct 10 episodes a year and not edit ever again?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's something I think about a lot. And, you know, we could probably have a whole podcast on kids and like directing or filmmaking. And that's a huge part of it. I love my kids. I love spending time with them. And, you know, the idea of directing, you know, 10, 12 episodes a year, there's no way they're all going to be in LA. Like, you know, that scares me of just like, how do I make that work? And all that. The short answer is I don't really know. Maybe the next time you have me on your podcast, I can give you an update. But I think the ideal for now is I would love to direct another episode this year, 2022. And if that happens, I'll be very happy. And if it doesn't, I'll still probably be pretty happy.
Eric, I think that you should continue to edit some of the best shows on TV and then pick up 2 episodes a season on whatever show you're on. That to me sounds like a perfect life.
I'm gonna go
and then,
for it.
You know, a feature in between seasons or whatever, whenever you're in the mood.
Right. Yeah.
And that could either be directing or editing, you know, whatever way the wind blows. That's my, that sounds good, man. That sounds good.
Give me a goal. I'm going to do it.
Truly, though, that's like a work-life balance. You're scratching all of the itches. You have tons of creative input on shows that you're proud of. That sounds pretty good. Yeah. Circling back a tiny bit, I guess when we first talked about having you on the show, I kind of kept thinking about every once in a while, and it's happened more and more later in my career, I've just been struck with like a brief feeling that I hate directing. Like, why the fuck am I doing this? Do you know what I mean? It's especially hard. Maybe you're especially tired. It's especially thankless. You know, there's there's a grueling grind to it, you know, you're just kind of like, all right, well, the next shot, we know it's an over the shoulder. We've all shot this 1,000 times and I'm going to make it as funny as I can, I guess. And it goes away. I had that feeling. And then I thought to myself, well, Eric's got this fulfilling creative career on the other side of the camera or the other side of the production pipeline, I guess you should say. And so when I say like, was it worth it? That's really what I'm talking about.
Right.
You know.
I know exactly the feeling you're talking about. I feel that feeling often when I think about directing. And I always think about the fact that 15 years ago, when I was first starting out as an editor, I felt that exact same way about editing. You know, that I mean, a lot of it was like kind of fear and exhaustion and like anxiety and all these things. And it's not like it ever went away completely, but it over the years just became sort of like a dull background hum that is almost gone, you know? And so in theory, I mean, you know, we have a sample size of 1, but in theory, I'm hoping that same thing happens with direction. Sure. that it just becomes,
I wonder if some of it is like, oh, I spent my whole life dreaming about this job and working towards it, and life is always hard. And like, it's just dealing with that realization.
I mean, I have 2 kind of thoughts on that. I think one, to me, like the thing that's been on my mind a lot lately is that I think, and I'm pretty sure this is wrong, but I get this feeling that the harder I work on directing, the better director I will be, you know? Like now, you know, I told you, Eric, I have 2 treatments due this week. I feel like the more hours I put into them, the better treatments they'll be and the better chance I will have to get the job. And then that is always like in my brain, but on the other side of my brain, it's like, hey, I don't want to like be up all night writing treatments and looking for images and making this 5% better and tweaking this and trying to outthink the other directors that I'm up against, you know, like that, like that doesn't sound fun to me. It actually like sounds exhausting. And
I mean, the hustle is for me the hardest part and the most unpleasant part. And it's essentially why I chose this path, because I basically realized that like I could, you know, do good work and earn, you know, some sort of cred as an editor doing something that I was good at and find my way to directing that way, as opposed to like wowing someone with a pitch or in a meeting or something, which I just like just had never gotten great at.
That's the other realization I've had is like, you know, I look at people like you or like our friend Blake, you know, who owns a company and is a EP there, but he also directs a ton. But I see him getting sometimes more satisfaction out of producing or being like on the creative side with a different director than actually directing himself, you know? And that's like, like to me, I mean, that's my primary job in life is a director right now, but I could see myself being just as happy working with other directors and like either being a producer or a writer or a creative director or editor. Like to me, touching the creative process has become more exciting on something that I'm excited about. has been more interesting to me than having the title of director. You know, sometimes I think the title of director is the thing that is the most right for me on a project. But other times, like I don't want to go on 100 scouts to find the perfect place for this, but I have an opinion on it and I'd love to team up with someone else on it. So I do think, you know, in the long run, a career as a director is, there's a lot of hustle, even if you're very successful. And a career in the creative arts can be creatively fulfilling and not destroy your life.
We haven't ended on a down note, have we? Are we?
No.
This happens sometimes. You guys get like introspective at the very end and
you
know, ask questions. Yeah, like, the last 100 episodes, Eric.
you started it 250 episodes ago. No, I think it is actually like a high note because it takes away that goal of like, I must direct, you know, the next HBO show and I must direct the next Marvel movie and be like, hey, I'd be pretty happy if I was one of the creative team that made this cool campaign or that sold this show, even if I'm not directing it.
There is the thing of learning what directing really is, right? When you start at film school, most people say they want to be a director. There's a couple people who want to be DPs or editors or whatever, but like the crop, 80%, they're like, I'm going to be a writer director. And that's because they think that all of their favorite movies, a writer director was responsible for them, right? And then slowly they realize, oh, this job is not what I thought it was, right? And then at a certain point, it's just a handful of people who are deciding that they still want to do it. And then you learn really what the job is. And I guess I think we're kind of at the top of that peak. And now we get to decide where else we want to go, whether it's better to like continue to do what essentially we're saying is that directing is a lot of labor and that you can still be as creatively influential in a lot of ways that make your life tangibly better, right? Like editing being to bring it full circle, editing from home, your quality of life is better. So you have to be addicted to directing specifically, not just making great creative work, but like the act of scouting 100 locations to find the perfect one has to still be fulfilling to you in order for it to be worth it. What I'm saying is that 99.9% of the time, yes. And then every once in a while, I'm like, dang, it's not right now.
Right. That's a pretty good percentage, honestly.
Yeah, it is. I'm living my dream. It sounds like I'm complaining. I'm truly living my dream.
Yeah.
I think 99% of the onset time, it's worth it. 80% of the prep time, it's worth it. 70% of the post time, it's worth it. And like 10% of the other times, it's worth it.
I think it's really only pitching and like those really demoralizing hard moments.
Yeah. Or almost getting it.
You love prep. You love post. You love that stuff, Warren.
Yeah, that's why I give
it
80% and 70%. it's just the like, you know, probably what most of our listeners are doing, the trying to get things greenlit, trying to convince people to hire you as a director, trying to, you know, say like, I directed a movie, I directed this short, I edited like 800 episodes of TV, and you don't think I'm like good enough to direct this episode? Like, to me, that stuff sometimes is overwhelming.
Yeah, the politics of it.
Yeah. But hey, it's all fun.
It is. It feels like a completely different set of skills to like get the job and do the job.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And like, and some people, you know, can combine the two and they're really truly at the peak.
Yeah. We know their names, right?
<That's> we know their names. But most of us, I know directors who are really great in the room and pitching and who I just don't think are very good directors, you know, on set, you know, and it's sometimes you get one or the other.
Well, Eric, do you mind sticking around to give us an unpaid endorsement?
Unpaid endorsements.
So I've got two endorsements. I'm going to take a quick survey. What do you two think is the single best place that has the single best comment threads on all of the internet?
Reddit. You're wrong. Or Nextdoor.
You're wrong. You're wrong twice, Oren.
Facebook.
The New York Times cooking section is nothing but great stuff. This is my rubric, basically.
Better than Deadline.
Yeah. Better than Deadline. Boy, for listeners who don't, Deadline's comments really, truly, truly depressing. As an antidote to that, the New York Times cooking section, all of the comments are germane. They're all thoughtful. They're all smart. And most of the time, it's like people reporting back with their results and their tweaks, which is like exactly what you're looking for in a recipe, right? For instance, I was like, I wonder if I could substitute oat milk in this one. And, you know, of course, a ton of people already had. They had some thoughts. Some people did this or that or whatever. It's like exactly what you want out of a comment section. So the New York Times cooking section in particular, those comments are worth it. And you can get a separate subscription, a digital subscription just for the cooking section if you don't want to pay for the whole newspaper. My other one is a record called Motherlode by James Brown. It's like mostly old, like deep cuts. It's kind of like vault recordings, basically. So it feels like mostly jam sessions. And the reason that I'm endorsing it specifically, besides being a longtime James Brown fan, is that it is great to write to. It's not especially melodic or verse-based. It's got the energy that you want out of like something that's driving and fun and energetic, but it's not distracting the way most pop songs are. The format isn't front and center. They're just kind of like riffing in a way that it's still as fun as you can ask for. So Motherlode is the endorsement. Also, that was the record playing when my daughter was born. And the doctor was like, this is great. It feels like we're in a movie right now.
That's cool.
And I was like, that's great. And so
there was a mother being
unloaded. So if you want to write or give birth and make it feel like an Ocean's 11 movie, Motherlode is your record. Eric, what you got, buddy?
It's very funny that my endorsement has the word mother in it as well. One of the things that I enjoyed most in life before the pandemic was going out to restaurants, and that has been a spotty affair for the past couple of years. But this week, my wife and I decided to have a nice meal at a restaurant called Mother Wolf, which is a new restaurant in Hollywood. It's a restaurant by a chef named Evan Funke, I believe. I probably said his name completely wrong. He is a crazy, like, yeah, exactly. It's like a sort of Nordic sounding name, but he's actually Italian. He's excellent. He's a restaurant in Venice called Felix, which is also very good.
I had reservations for there for New Year's pre-Omicron, and they called us to tell us they're not going to be open.
Well, there you go. Well, now you don't have to go all the way to the West Side to try his food, because he opened up a new restaurant in Hollywood called Mother Wolf. It's in the Citizen News building, which is an incredible old Hollywood building. The space has been like redone, and it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous space, just giant ceilings. Everything's beautiful. The food was incredible. The staff was amazing. And it just had this like, it had this joyous energy to it. People were very, very happy to be out and eating good food in a good restaurant. And so, you know, I'd say in general, everyone's got their own feelings about risk. But if you have any desire to do so, please do. And please go to a restaurant like Mother Wolf, or just, you know, you'll just have a great time.
Well, that was a perfect way to bridge endorsements, because A, you know, I have a son named Wolf. And because we all have kids now, I'm going to give three endorsements that are kid related. If you don't have kids, you can just stop listening to the podcast right now. Sorry, I apologize. I'll try to give these pretty fast. First of all, if you have a kid and it's their birthday, you know, you can create like a registry for your kid's birthday so that your family actually gives them something that you don't have to throw away. Amazon is the most obvious place you can make like a wish list for a birthday, but do it, because we've, you know, if you have a newborn, sometimes you have 800 swaddle blankets, but you don't have enough onesies that your baby just grew out of or whatever. So just kid birthday gift registry. And then another thing kid related is, you know, there's this general annoyance people have, especially people without kids, when you start posting a million pictures of your kid on Instagram. What we found works best for our kid photos is we have a Apple shared album. And you can, just because it's like a shared album doesn't mean only your family can be in it. So we have like our friends that want to see pictures of our kid are shared on this album. And then we have no qualms about uploading 20 photos because we just went on a trip or something, where you should never upload 20 photos of your kid to Instagram. Yeah, make an album for your family and your close friends and mention it to your friends. If they want to see photos, they will. If they don't, they just will not respond. And then my last thing, this is like a kind of good pandemic trick is we have a crib, you know, for our baby. And we also had, it's the same crib that our daughter, our older daughter slept in. And on the wall, we had a lot of our family lives all over the world. I have family in Israel. Kara's family is in Ohio. And so we got this like string and little, you know, C-47s, when you call them, clothespins. And we have pictures of all our family members, the step family, the aunts, the uncles, the grandparents, everyone that are just like hanging above the crib. And then like our kids get to see what like they know who all the family members are, even though there's a pandemic going on and all those things. So just a cool idea. I think it was my wife saw it somewhere, and we did it with our daughter and now with our son. And now like, hopefully when he meets his grandfather, then he hasn't seen for 2 years, he'll know who he is, you know, because there's pictures of the family members. So that's it. Three kid things. If you don't have kids, you can tune back in now. Anyway, well, Eric, thanks so much. If people want to follow you, do you post pictures of your kids publicly or anything?
I do post. I post a lot of pictures of my kids. Actually, I haven't for a while, but you can go to my Instagram at Eric Kissack.
Eric Kissack. K-I-S-S-A-C-K.
And Eric, do you have a website that you're updating at all or anything like that? Or
I have a website that occasionally gets updated, but if you're curious to see any of my short films or the Good Place web series, you can see that all there. It's erickkissack.com. erickissack.com.
Well, if you have any questions about this episode, please email us at justshootitpod@gmail.com. If you want to tell Eric you loved his episode of Rutherford Falls, let us know and we'll forward it on to him. You can follow us across all social media at Just Shoot It Pod. You can follow me on Instagram. I'm at O Kaplan. On Twitter, I'm at Smitey Pyleg.
And I'm across all social media at Mr. Matt Enlow. This episode was edited by Noah Bayshore. Thanks, Noah. Welcome to the team. Your Patreon money is going straight to that dude. And you're listening to music by the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. Thanks, everyone. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.